to each other before you're married, the more you'll have built your home on a foundation of mutual attraction and mutual benefit, rather than on a foundation of mitzvah and God. So on the superficially, it appears like the more time you spend together, the better it is. As we mentioned, it says, the Halacha in Shulchan Aruch says, that even after you already had Kedushim, and you didn't yet have Nisuin, you should stay as far away from each other, you shouldn't be too close to each other, because you might get disgusted with each other. Why? Because when your relationship is built on mutual benefit, there's the possibility that today you turn me on, tomorrow you turn me up. I'm no longer interested. But when your commitment is based on a mitzvah, when your commitment is based on God, and the relationship is an outgrowth of that, then there's no concern. We're not concerned that you have to spend the rest of your life together. We're concerned about the few moments you'll spend together before you're bonded by God's mitzvahs. That we're concerned about. But once that is the foundation of your marriage, is the mitzvah, the foundation of your marriage is to build a godly home, then we're not concerned about, of course you can spend your whole life together, that's the point. But before that, even spending a little time together, now I like you, tomorrow I don't. Yes, I'm going to go.
You said in the beginning, that a Jewish marriage is not about fulfillment. So if you get married and you're doing the God thing, is there room for happiness?
Okay, the question...
The life of maintenance.
Okay. The question is like this. The question is that if Jewish marriage is not about personal fulfillment, it's only about the pursuit of Torah and mitzvahs, so does that leave out all the good feelings, the happiness and joy, whatever it is, the good feelings that people look for in marriage? Is it just purely, very purely technical kind of thing? Okay, so that takes us back to, I started this lecture with certain givens and certain assumptions. And one is that it's built on certain basic assumptions of Hasidus before we even started. I can't do the whole Hasidus in one sitting. I can do it in 1,000 sittings. And one of the assumptions is that experiencing the life of Torah Mitzvah as technical, as unreal, as an imposed activity, as strictly behavioral, and experiencing your other endeavors as real, that is part of the situation that we are meant to remedy and correct. That's what we were sent to this world to do. That our Torah and Mitzvahs, we should experience them with the greatest measure of joy and happiness and enthusiasm and excitement and vigor. And the things that we do because they're necessary should be technical and feel like an imposed behavior. Like Dr. Deva brings that when Hillel went to eat, he told his students, I have to feed this poor slob, referring to his physical body, that he unfortunately he has to go away from the things that are truly meaningful and what his life is really all about, and take care of those things which are necessary. You have to do it, what can you do? Okay, so what Hasidus really, I mean, the first step, what Hasidus is all about, the Tanya, he starts off with the question that if you think you're wicked, you won't be able to serve God with joy. I mean, that's one of the first things that he starts off with. That the whole basis of Hasidus is learning how to make Torah Mitzvahs your reality, rather than just a legalistic code of behaviors, which when you do things like that, they feel very... You feel very detached, they feel very depersonalized, and they feel like you're just going through the motions. So, along with creating, part of the process of creating a Jewish marriage based on Torah and Mitzvahs and God, not as a thing, but as your life, that's how you learn to actually experience your life that way. Through marriage is what gives you that power to transcend those secular and worldly ideas of what is called living, and as opposed to what is called fulfilling your obligations, and the Torah Mitzvah becomes your living, and those other things become technical obligations. That's part of the that is very much part of the issue that we're trying to deal with.
So there should be diversity.
So now we come to a whole new question. The new question is as follows. The question is, in general, if we're talking about the home as the model for this is the place where we can actually make the reality of the third Beis Hamikdash in our own homes, and yet a great portion of our homes, of our time spent in our homes, is spent involved in very mundane matters. This is a question that the Rebbe has himself discussed, and the Rebbe actually points out that if you come into the Beis Hamikdash and you watch the Kehanim at work, you would wonder, most of their time is spent with chopping meat, cutting it up, preparing it, schlepping, cleaning, washing. So again, if you look at it with purely secular eyes, it seems like drudge work. It seems like a lot of chores, a lot of drudgery, and it seems quite menial. However, the fact is that when your activities are imbued with the awareness that every one of these activities is part of a divine mission, okay, when you're involved in a divine mission, then the lower the activity that a person is willing to do to fulfill their mission, the greater we honor such a person. In other words, if there was a person who had military information that was going to save his country, and he got into his car and he was in the enemy country and he has this vital information that's going to save his country. So if he gets in his car, he drives over the border to his country and he knocks on the door of whoever, of the head of intelligence, and he gives him over this information. He's a hero. Okay? But what if in order to get there, he has to crawl through the mud and he has to hide out in a latrine, and he has to crawl and schlep and come and go, and he has to sign on as a short order cook on a train in order to get a ride, and he has to do all kinds of menial and lowly things. The more of those things he would do, the more we would consider that person a hero. It would be a far greater hero for doing all of those things in order to save his country. Why? Those are all lowly menial things. That's true. But Dafka and the lowly menial things have the potential to be imbued with the greatest meaning. Spiritual things, they're full of meaning, but whatever they mean, they mean. You can't transform them. You can't elevate them. They are what they are. It's the lowly things. It's the lowly menial things that if they're done towards a cause of supreme importance and it's meant to fulfill a divine mission, it is those, the lower and the more menial the activity, the greater is the accomplishment. You wanted to ask a question. Okay, I was going, I don't know.
What you're describing to me sounds like the ideal, what the Torah wants, that both parties should recognize ultimately we both parties have the same purpose and they're united in that. But in my perception, the majority of marriages are really, really like a far cry from that. And you're saying, well, we all have the potential, and I assume you're saying, like, you know, everyone has the potential to do vanity, so too we all have the potential to make those marriages work. My concern is that if for someone who is in a marriage that's far cry from that, and the woman who usually seems to be the one who's more concerned about how the marriage is going and all that, and she takes it upon herself to try to like adopt this new reality, and sometimes will put herself in a situation where she's really been, there are some unacceptable things in that marriage, and that because there's such a, I don't think there's enough allowance in the community for for a person to say that this is an untenable situation, because the message that I think she's going to be given is, well, you are responsible, you're the acarus of bias, you're responsible for creating a proper, you know, situation in your home. You have to give without wanting to take the return, which by and large, for certain marriages is good advice, but what about very, very many marriages where that's not appropriate? Then that woman, I think, is encouraged to be in the situation.
Okay, the question, if I understand it correctly, is that since generally when it comes to improving marriage situations and working on marriage, it generally women will seek out an attempt to try to improve things. And there are certain situations where if the woman will take on the burden, so to speak, of creating the perfect marriage, it will just add an additional burden, and the other side won't cooperate, and it's just gonna, it's gonna backfire.
And I'm really, what I was trying to say is that there are a lot of marriages where there's really serious problems other than, it's the one, abuse is one of them, you know, whatever you want to find it. Alcoholism, extreme financial stress, children who are, like, whatever, physically disabled, or some really serious problems that put tremendous stress on the marriage, and that unless both partners share the perception that you're describing, I think it's really, it's hard for me to see how they could just kind of be resolved by the woman taking on this new attitude. And the danger is that she's going to put that responsibility on herself, and when it doesn't work, still feel responsible for it, rather than looking to other options or other person to be involved in whatever.
Okay. The question, so now let's say the question this way, that there are situations in which there are other stresses on the marriage, other situations which have to be dealt with, and the question is, how can just taking on this attitude resolve all those issues? And if not, then the person who's trying to do it might end up not only not succeeding, because they'll also end up bearing the burden and feeling responsibility for the fact that it did not succeed. Okay.
That's
more common than we think.
Yeah.
Okay, the issue is like this. Most, now, and Rabbi Twersky will have to forgive me, and I strongly disagree with him on, I mean, at least based on the sickness of the Rebbe, but most, I would say, almost every single case of these other type of situations are based on the fear that one party or the other has. Most situations that people get into is based on the fear that there is something expected of them more than they are capable of giving. You know, in situations where husbands withdraw or get into, you mentioned alcoholism or abuse or other situations, the overwhelming majority of all of these situations, all of these cases, are when a man or a woman, more often than not a man, find themselves in a situation where they feel that there are expectations of them that they feel inadequate to living up to. And therefore, they feel trapped. And because they feel trapped, they seek escape in one form or another. And often, now the other situation which you mentioned, which is a purely objective situation, a handicapped child, that could just as easily be a force to bring two people together as it is to separate two people. And again, that just simply has to do with their attitude. I mean, that's not necessarily something which objectively tears people apart. Okay. But I'm just talking about a situation where you say one partner is acting against the other partner. More often than not, it is because they have a feeling of being trapped and a feeling of, I will never be good enough for you. Now, whose fault it is, I don't know. Like I told you, I really don't care. So what that person, however, may need outside intervention, and they may need somebody, but if one spouse, the one who is concerned that I am not good enough for the other spouse, gets the message that I am not making demands upon you, okay, that our relationship is not based on what you do for me. It's not based on living up to a certain set of expectations. But our relationship is based on the fact that God put us together to make this home a godly place. When I get the sense that that is what, when one partner gets the sense that that is what the other person wants, they don't feel that tremendous burden of not living up to expectation. So again, they may not be able to work it out themselves. They might need to call on an outside party who knows about these ideas, which unfortunately there aren't too many yet in the world. And that these ideas in itself are the ultimate, conflict resolution in an alcoholic situation really works.
Yeah, but even if
The only thing that could possibly work, or in abusive situations, the only thing that could possibly work is if you find the cause, what is making that other person feel that they have to run away, or that they have to lash out. I don't want to get off into.
She's really looking at it though from the woman's point of view, and I would say that using this paradigm of that you're looking at, in other words, instead of you want to put God.
The point that's being made is that that when you are actually concerned and looking out for the best interest of another person doesn't mean actually giving in to everything they say that they want. I mean, that should be fairly obvious. I mean, that's, Chazal tell us that a student, a child, and a wife, you have to, the way you treat them is yamin mekarevus and smel dechen, that the right hand draws close and the left hand pushes away. You know, it's, people have to know their limits. People have to know, it's obviously we're talking about a situation where you're only helping people. We're not talking about a situation where giving in or taking abuse or encouraging negative behaviors. That's not the way you achieve this higher peace, and it's not the way you achieve the divine reality, because that kind of behavior is ungodly behavior. What we do is that by behaving ourselves in a godly fashion and encouraging in others godly behavior, what happens is you bring out in those people that which is godly about themselves. Mm-hmm. See, one of the things that I also have to deal with, someone mentioned their teenage children, one of the things that I'm very involved in is with teenage children who are, I get them after every other part of the system has finished with them. So I generally will get hold of teenage kids after their parents give up on them, the schools give up on them, they've been to psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, so on and so forth, they went through everything and anything, and now they're out on the streets. And then, that's usually about when people think of calling me. So, and that's when I get them. And what do I do? What do I do when I'm sitting with a kid who's totally out of everything and anything? I make no demands on them. None, zero, zip, zilch, nothing. I ask them for nothing, I expect nothing from them. All I do is give them. And part of what I give them is, I give them the belief that there's something very good and very special inside of them that they have the capacity to reveal. And not that I'm going to do it for them, and that no one in the world could do it for them, and no one could force them to, and no one could make them do it, and no one could, they have to do it on their own. And so all of conventional wisdom that I have ever encountered says that this approach should not work. The only source that I ever found that this approach should work, okay, is from the Rebbe. But every other source of conventional wisdom says that, you know, either in its most extreme form, this tough love. And then you have all kinds of other systems which say, listen, even the people who talked about prison as rehabilitation are now writing books to say, forget it, it doesn't work, just do like they do in Singapore, whip them. Because they're all saying rehabilitation doesn't work, it doesn't work. You can't bring out the best in people unless you beat it into them. And what happens is the hardest people for me to get to cooperate with me are parents. Because when I tell the parents, I say, listen, once your son hooks up with me, you should know he's going to deteriorate, or daughter, they're going to deteriorate terribly, because I make no demands. And they're going to try to, in order to prove that I really, really accept them, they're going to try to stretch my limits. And they're going to do the craziest, wildest things, either not in front of me or in front of me, to really see if I'm going to take it. And because that's part of really testing if there's that kind of love and that kind of acceptance. But when they get it, it's amazing how they turn around. It's just a totally amazing thing. People who are completely written off by everyone and everything as incorrigible are now Bachram sitting and learning yeshivas, and you would not know where they have been. So what happens is we live in a world where people are scared, and it's scary to suggest that you could take the risk of loving someone so completely and still expect to come out ahead. And everyone has to put in some kind of caveat, some kind of, you know, well, you know, you have to be careful, you have to know, don't take it too far, don't get... And basically, that's everyone feels that you have to do that to one degree or another. And sometimes it's even suggested that it's irresponsible to not do that. I think that if we take the risk, we take the plunge, and we go that step further, again, where outside help is needed. That's part of what needs to be done, no question about it. But to take the risk of seeing the Rebbe's vision, of going beyond the issue of what do I need, or what do I have to get out of this, or what the balance is, or whose fault it is, if you can really, really put yourself beyond that issue, the response that the other party will have is nothing short of amazing. But you have to stay the course, and it's not always easy. Yes?
God's will, it's union with your spouse, and then maybe something that God is crazy or something like that. What should you on that? Which how in that moment are you supposed to switch into that approach?
Okay. The question is that if you're that in your day-to-day life, where the normal daily things, the irritants and conflicts that come up, your spouse does something that you find irritating, how do you switch into this new mode on the spot? Mm-hmm. Of being beyond the issue of right and wrong and so on and so forth. Okay, the answer to that question is as follows. If I'm running, there are a lot of things that if my spouse does them, they're extremely irritating. That if other people did, I couldn't care less. Why is that? The reason that is very simple. Because I have expectations from my spouse. I feel that my spouse owes me A, B, C, X, Y, Z. Okay? And therefore, okay, it's true. Now, if I went to work and my boss did the same thing, that's it. Life goes on. You know what I mean? I'm not going to lose my job over it. If I have to deal with other people in many other situations, there are minor irritants that the nature of the irritant is built on expectance, you know, expectations. Because I expect it and I feel I need and I have the right to demand things, therefore I find such and such a behavior irritating. But if I'm running a Chabad house, okay, and this person passes through my Chabad house, and I'm trying to bring them closer to God, and they do things that I find irritating, so what? That's part of running a Chabad house and bringing people closer to God. It depends how you look at your house. Because we have these secular views and we have these kind of expectations, so there are things that we find irritating. The fact is that when you accept somebody who is irritating you, and you show them that kind of love and acceptance, then when they reciprocate, okay, it's with a far greater love and acceptance than if you actually get into an argument over it, and you actually win the argument, and the person never does that irritating thing again, okay, you push yourself further apart. When you will overlook that and accept the person with the irritant, you have a much likelier chance of being far closer, and that at some point the person will give up doing whatever it is that's irritating you. So in the long run, you have to take the long, short way. But in the long run, you end up a lot better off than if you just look for short-term results and have your demands being met. Okay, so the question is that it would seem that there are times when expectations are necessary just to let the other person know what it is that you expect, what it is that you want, the things that are necessary, even if they're not necessarily selfish, but they're necessary for the home to run and operate. Okay, the fact is that there's two different types of ways of having expectations. When you have an expectation of someone, and you're both on the same side, they experience your expectation very differently than when you have an expectation from someone and the feeling is that you're on different sides. Even if you're on different sides that are peaceful and are working well together, but an expectation from someone on the other side is experienced very differently than an expectation from someone on my side. So when my son looks up to me and he expects from me certain things, okay, that makes me want to do it. Because I know his expectation comes from the fact that he looks up to me and he admires me and he feels connected to me and proud and by extension of anything that I do, that he looks up to. So when I get that kind of message of expectation, I want to go out and do it. When I get a message of expectation which says, I want this, I want that for me, then that message makes me want to back off. Then I start feeling trapped. I start feeling cornered. And what if I don't want to do it? And what if I do it? And what if I don't do it well enough? That's when I start feeling like, you know, I have to stop bargaining. I have to stop bargaining down the expectations. So when the expectations are coming from the same side, they are a stimulant and a source of motivation and inspiration. When the expectations are coming from someone on the other side of the bargaining table, it makes you pull back and it makes you want to bargain. It makes you want to get away with giving as little as you can. So of course expectations are an important part of any relationship. But they have to be expectations of two people that are one, that are on the same side, not on opposing sides.
I think that's what Karen's question is. What happens when you're on that side?
What happens when you're on the opposing side?
That's pulling back because you feel
like... Okay, so I'm saying when you're pulling back, that's natural, that's normal, that's human. We're talking about transcending your natural, normal human reactions. Okay? We're talking about connecting to a higher godly reality. And that's why sometimes what you have to do is, you have to be able to depersonalize. In other words, right now, there's certain ways we experience things when we see ourselves as in the event. We experience those same things very differently when we see ourselves as observers. If we could step back from the same event, we experience them very differently. So the same event, that if you feel like you're a participant in it, it could bring out one reaction. If you're looking at it from an observer, bystander point of view, you get a different kind of more objective, detached reaction. So what happens is sometimes in a relationship, you have to be able to detach and pull back, because right now you're experiencing this event as a conflict. So what you have to do is be able to stand back, detach, and say, listen, this person that I live with has a neshama. That neshama is a part of God. Therefore, it is my job to do kindness. It's a job. I have a job. This is what I have to do. When I could pull back and detach, depersonalize, okay, and get back to the point where I started my marriage, doing a mitzvah with a total stranger, okay, that's where I started from. I get back to the point where I have objectified the situation, depersonalized, got out of all the emotional stuff that's going on, and I step out, then I get back to that point, then I can go back into the relationship and experience it with all the experiences of the thrill and the joy and the happiness and all of those things, but experiencing it from within a relationship that's built on the mitzvah, that's built on godliness, that's built on our being one and the same, rather than on two sides. I think there's someone back there that hasn't been...
I can understand when you love without a marriage, if you're talking about a child in the situation, or when you're talking about spouses when you're the only one. But basically, bottom line is when you have a full family, you have children, you have lots of children, you have lots of problems, there's lots of things to do. And like she was saying, expecting things to help the family work, it's not so much that you have to demand sometimes, because the way to run things, I see how to do it one way, my spouse sees how to do it another way, and then you're in the thick of things, and that's where the conflict comes in. When, you've got to sometimes say, I need you to do this so that I can, breathe, so I can live, so I can go to the bathroom. I mean,
okay, so let me put the...
People see the way things work.
Right. Okay, let me put the question a little differently and tell me if it fits what you're trying to ask. That sometimes before you can, even if and while you're pursuing an ideal, there are times that the practical situation, just getting through the day, requires that you set certain rules and make certain demands and expect certain things just so that things should run.
My point is that there's no time to sit there and say, well, I expect of you that you should do this, and then this will, you're working on, you know, this may be falling down the steps, this one that needs life change, this one is this. They're, you're not talking about a family where there's two people and the children are, it's going to be, you know, one child, and they're all, you know, nice and tucked in, and now you have the evening to yourself while you go out and go to the, you're not talking about families like that, you're talking about busy families with a lot of things going on.
Okay, so let's say the question a little differently. That sometimes homes are so busy that we don't have time to do the things that will make the homes work right. I don't think that's the way you wanted to say it, but I think that's what's coming across. The issue is like this. The issue is that, and this is something that is being universally recognized even in the secular world, that people get so caught up in the here and now, okay, in getting through the day, that they don't take the time out to develop those things or those skills or those attitudes which will make their day work better. That is no question that the natural instinct of people is to go with the flow. Even when the flow is lousy, okay, people go... You don't have to. What I'm trying to tell you is that life is not planning. Okay, life. I'm not talking about planning. I'm talking about developing a set of attitudes. Okay, which enable you to deal with any contingency as unexpected as it might be. So a person who's going on shlichus, okay, a person who considers themselves a private person, and 60 guests show up on their doorstep unexpected, okay, will not be able to cope. The same person, if they are on a mission, they are on shlichus, it is their mission to attract as many people as possible, and 60 people show up unexpectedly on their doorstep, they will cope. They're excited. It's the first time they ever had, they're here for 10 years, the first time they ever had 60 people show up on their doorstep. Okay, so again, it may be just as difficult, it may be more difficult. But the fact is, because they know it, because in their attitude, in their frame of mind, this is a desirable thing. This is an opportunity to fulfill the godly mission that I was sent to do. So they experience that same event very differently than somebody who sees the same events as an intrusion on my time, on my space, on my life, on me. So attitude, really, how you experience things and how you see things and how you live experiences is all based on your attitude. That is the same exact event, the same exact experience, okay? There are people who, if their kid doesn't listen to them, it's a tragedy. It ruined their day. And there are other people who, if their kid doesn't want to listen to them, they say, ah, a teaching moment. They're excited. I now have a teaching moment. I can teach my child an important lesson for life. So it's the same exact event. But it depends what you're looking for. If what you're looking for is to get through the day, so you're right, there's always going to be things coming up that are going to make it that much more difficult to get through the day, and less time to be godly. But if your focus is being godly, then everything that will come up in your day will be another opportunity to be godly.
My point isn't so much me getting through. Me getting through the day maybe slightly a bit easier because somebody else lived up to my expectation and did something without me having to ask or did it.
So I'm telling you, the most effective way to get that, is if everyone's on your side. If you're running a home with ten different planets and 10 different orbits, and everyone is trying to pull them all into one semblance of order, then of course there's friction and chaos, because the more people you have, the more egos you have bouncing around in the same house, the more crowded it gets.
I don't think it'll ever matter how you get through the day, as much as that a man sees things differently than a woman sees things, and how it will work is different from each point of view. And
How it'll work?
Are you supposed to forego the me and look for a higher whatever, and if he's sort of rousing up, let him do it? Or are you supposed to demand from him?
Again. The issue here is, we're saying that what I'm trying to tell you is that when you're on the same side, you can have far greater expectations, and they will be fulfilled. When you are on conflicting sides...
You can be on the same side for the kid and for the family, mm-hmm. and I can be doing my part, and I can be doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And your spouse can see that everything's running smoothly and say, okay, I can sit.
Then you're not on the same side. Then you're not on the same side. He could never say that if he was on your side. In other words, when you see a home as a division of labor, okay, a division of labor. You know, my father's been a marriage counselor for many, many years. And he had this couple come to him, and they had a very serious problem. What was their very serious problem? The very serious problem is that they both worked from 9 to 5. They both got up 7 in the morning, or 6:30. The man went to a shir, daven shacharis, came home to eat breakfast and go to work. The woman, on the other hand, got up, got the kids ready for school, made breakfast, and then she also went to work. They both came home 5 o'clock. The man got on the couch with his newspaper, and the woman had to first go into the kitchen to start making supper and take care of the kids and everything else. So they came, and they were at the point of divorce. When they came to my father, and he said, listen, I work hard all day to support my family. I come home in the evening, the least I can get is a rest. He says, I don't need her to work. We have enough money for my job alone. Who has her to go to work anyway? And she said, I'm working full time, the same amount of time as him, and he comes home at night and gets on the couch, and I first have to go into the kitchen and go to work and start dealing with the kids. So my father said, I'm sorry you came to the wrong person. I can't help it. So they said, what do you mean? You're a marriage counselor, right? If I said, no. If I said, you need a labor consultant. You have a certain amount of jobs that have to get done. You have a certain amount of time and energy to do it in. You need a labor consultant to divide who should take out the garbage, who should do this, who should do that. Says, I don't know anything about that. I know about relationships. You want some help with a relationship, I can help you. But if you want to know how to handle a division of labor, I don't know. So they were smart enough, they were intelligent enough that when they presented to them that way, it hit them how foolish they were being. You know, it's how distracted they had become from what the marriage is really all about and gotten caught in a very side issue. When we experience those kind of issues, we experience them in very intense ways. They're very, very intense. When you're in a situation where you want something done and the other person's not doing it, you're furious. The emotion is extremely intense and extremely powerful. No one is playing down how strongly you feel those feelings. Those feelings are very strong and very real for you. The reason you are feeling them, though, is because of your attitude. To give an example how attitudes influence our feelings, okay? You meet someone in the street. You meet someone in the street, they pass you by, and it's somebody you haven't seen for a while, and they're the kind of person that you would expect that if they saw you on the street, they would say hello. And the person walks right down past you on the street, and they ignore you. Person passes you on the street, they ignore you, you come home, you're all upset. Your day is ruined, you're furious, you're hurt, you're humiliated, you're broken, how could they walk down the street, pass me on the street, and ignore me? And you're feeling, you're going through a very intense range of emotion. Very intense feelings, they're very intense and they're very real. And your day is ruined. Okay? That night, you go to a class on being Dan Lekavskos. Go to a class on being Dan Lekavskos, that you have to come up with a reason why the other person did something, and they probably had a good reason. So you come home at night, and you're feeling guilty. Okay. So besides for all these other yucky feelings that you have, you now have guilt on top. So you figure, okay, let me try. So you sit and you try to talk it into yourself that they must have had a good reason like this and a good reason like that, and they had this reason, they had that reason, and you're trying to like subdue your emotions, so a little bit you succeed in suppressing your emotions, but your feelings are still really there. Below the surface, they're still simmering, you're still hurt. What happens if you find out the next day someone tells you, did you hear about so-and-so? That yesterday in the morning they had this terrible tragedy. You find out that that person, right before they passed you on the street, had just experienced a terrible tragedy. Your feelings will change in an instant. You don't have to work on your feelings. You hear a shir about being down the cop's clothes. You have to work on your feelings. As soon as you have the information that they went through something terrible, and that's why they passed you on the street, all your hurt and humiliation, everything will disappear. Does it mean that you're a bad person for having those feelings? No. But it means that those feelings were only relevant to your perception of the situation as you were. But they're not, they were real for you, but they were not, did not necessarily reflect actual reality. When you're in a situation, you experience it different than if you could stand back and have all, and see it as it actually is. So basically what you have to do is now work on the symptom. Okay? Because as soon as you start trying to work on the symptom, the other person gets defensive and feels that and starts to pull away even more. So if you need instant results, then I can't help you. If you need instant results, then you go to the seamy side of town and hire someone with a crowbar to let him know that he'll get his legs broken if he doesn't start showing up for stuff. It could work. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't know about that stuff. The idea is that he should help you and not get his legs broken. Okay. So I don't know. You know what I mean? But the question is, you want to build a home. A home is a long range process. Okay. A home is not something built in an instant. If you want to build a home with this person, and that the home should work together and function efficiently, so what you have to do is, again, you have to go back to the source. You have to reconnect. You have to focus on developing the kind of connection, okay, which makes the other person feel unthreatened. And when the person is in a situation where they feel unthreatened, then they will do even more than you expected.
So it seems like the other person can do no wrong. It just seems that people can sometimes feel threatened. No,
the other person can do no wrong. The other person can do terrible things. They can do terrible things, but it's not what's relevant. What's relevant is not who's right, who's wrong, and whose fault it is. What's relevant is what can we do about it. And what you could do about it is if you create an atmosphere and an environment in which there's a feeling of that we're really part of one unit, part of one entity, focused on one goal, and by that avoid all those other issues. Okay, I just want to respond that the point that you're making, especially the introduction that you gave, that many speakers will say what the woman could do to make the home look nice and prepare nice meals and be smiling and friendly. I didn't mention any of that, and there was a reason that I didn't mention any of that. Because all of these suggestions and all of these things, like I said, there's a lot of material about Shalom Weiss that most of you have probably heard and heard many times, and I said you will not hear that from me. Because what we're trying to do here is move away from the old systems, all the old systems which worked to whatever degree that they worked, even according to Torah. Okay? We're showing here how the Rebbe is presenting us with an entirely new system. An entirely new system of connecting, of bonding, of unifying with another human being, which totally transcends all of those issues. And therefore, if I sat here with a group of men, I would give them the identical speech, with no differences whatsoever. I would give them the identical speech because it's not an issue of who does this and who does that and how they do it and why they do it. The issue is, again, that the focus, all of the previous advice that exists on how to make a marriage work are all based on the assumption that the marriage is a relationship and everything else, including Torah and mitzvahs and all these things, have a place in the relationship. What we're suggesting here is a whole new type of relationship. It is a departure. It is a radical change in Jewish relationships. And that is that the entire nature of the relationship is two parts of God bringing about a greater revelation of God. And the defining nature of the revelation is God, not my personality, not your personality, not what I do, not what you do, but rather both of us living with and working together to express the reality of God, as discussed at length in the earlier part of the... Absolutely not. First of all, your Zaydis probably never even heard about the concept of two... I'm saying most people's Zaydis did not even hear of the concept of most people approach marriage. Again, using Torah sources, I'm not telling you that they were not using Torah sources. Using Torah sources, that marriage is something you do when you reach a certain age. And part of it is, and an important part of it is Torah, mitzvahs, and, you know, the mitzvahs that you do in the marriage are an important part of it. But the fact that God is the defining, that God is the defining element of the marriage, and seeing each component of the marriage as only as a part of God, and therefore ultimately all one entity and not separate parts that have to learn how to work together, there was no such concept because it was not available.